Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. Migrants trying to reach Western Europe refused to leave a railway train and head to a detention camp Thursday, then scuffled with Hungarian police trying to remove them. The police halted a crowded train heading for the Austrian border and ordered all refugees aboard to leave and go to a nearby migrants' reception center. Many of the families on the train said they were fleeing the civil war in Syria, trying to reach a safe haven in Europe. The migrants aboard the train, many of them impoverished and hungry, were only a minuscule part of a flood of up to 500,000 refugees bound for Europe, according to the president of the European Parliament, Martin Schulz. As China flourished its military power in a spectacular parade Thursday, commemorating the victory over Japan in World War II, President Xi Jinping announced that he plans to cut the world's largest military force by 300,000, or 10%. In a speech he delivered shortly before a stream of tanks, ballistic missiles, drones, and goose-stepping soldiers rolled through Beijing's Tiananmen Square, Xi said the troops cuts are in the interests of peace. Officials said the troop cuts will be completed by 2017. A 70-gun salute, a lavish display of military hardware, and the release of thousands of doves and balloons brought the event to a symbolic close. Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei expressed support Thursday for a parliamentary vote in Iran on the nuclear deal Tehran agreed to with a group of six world powers. In July, Iran and five permanent members of the UN Security Council and Germany agreed to a plan that calls for Iran to limit its nuclear enrichment activity in exchange for sanctions relief. This is VOA News. In Turkey, a British journalist and cameraman have been released from jail. The detention of the two men charged under the country's anti-terror laws has sparked growing criticism nationally and internationally. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Journalist Jake Hanrahan and cameraman Philip Pendlebury were released from a high-security jail Thursday. No official reason for their release has so far been given, but their colleague Mohamed Rasul remains imprisoned. Their detention has provoked strong criticism both in Turkey and abroad, with the European Union and US State Department voicing concern. Andrew Gardner of the human rights group Amnesty International says more needs to be done.
It's very good news that the two journalists have been released. However, Mohamed Rasul is still in prison and he should be freed immediately as well.
The men were arrested last week in Diyarbakir, in Turkey's predominantly Kurdish southeast, while reporting on renewed fighting between the Turkish state and the Kurdish rebel group, the PKK. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
Against the backdrop of war in Iraq, Yemen, and Syria, and concerns about Iran's behavior in the Middle East, U.S. President Barack Obama will welcome Saudi King Salman to the White House Friday. It will be the Arab leader's first visit to the United States since ascending the throne in January, following the death of King Abdullah. The talks between President Obama and the king could not come at a more tumultuous time, as a U.S.-led coalition fights Islamic State militants in Iraq and Syria, and a Saudi-led coalition beats back Iranian-supported Houthi rebels in Yemen. The World Health Organization has again declared Liberia Ebola-free after 42 days without a laboratory-confirmed case of the deadly virus. The WHO announced the news Thursday. The nation now goes into a 90-day period of what the WHO called heightened surveillance as health officials watch for any recurrence of the virus. Guatemalan President Otto Perez Molina has resigned after being connected to a corruption case. Guatemala's lawmakers stripped Mr. Perez Molina of his immunity on Tuesday. He is accused of orchestrating a customs fraud scheme known as The Line. The scandal has already resulted in the resignation of six of his cabinet ministers and his former vice president. Hundreds of protesters gathered outside a federal courthouse in Kentucky where a local county clerk faces charges for refusing to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples. Rowan County Clerk Kim Davis defied last month's court order to resume issuing marriage licenses to all eligible couples, straight or gay, practice she stopped after the U.S. Supreme Court's historic ruling in June that legalized same-sex marriages. Davis says issuing marriage licenses to same-sex couples would violate her religious beliefs. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Ruhiben. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
We often really get focused on the political and military developments in the Middle East and North Africa at the moment. And what this report is really telling us is the massive human cost, particularly for children, of the crises and conflicts in this region.
That's Peter Salama of UNICEF reporting on the effects of conflict on education. Details coming up.
Also, according to Human Rights Watch, five countries, among them Libya and Sudan, have used cluster munitions this year, causing unacceptable harm to civilians.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from DRC, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, as Hungary struggles with thousands of migrants headed for European refuge, Prime Minister Viktor Orban complains that the crisis is Germany's problem. Mr. Orban spoke out after EU officials met in Brussels today on the massive flows of people from the Middle East and Africa. Hungary's prime minister said it's not a European problem. The problem is a German problem. Nobody would like to stay in Hungary. All of them want to go to Germany. Germany has welcomed a large number of migrants this year and expects to receive 800,000 by the end of the year. Meanwhile, dozens of Budapest police withdrew from the capital city's main Kocsis station today. Their departure ended a two-day standoff with thousands of migrants demanding to board Vienna-bound trains. However, Hungary's rail officials now accept only passengers with EU documents for westbound routes to Germany and Austria. Migrants without EU visas can only travel to non-EU countries.
When Hungarian security personnel forced the migrants from a train 33 kilometers from the Austrian border, some lay down on the tracks in protests, others ran away. The officials were trying to move them into a migrant reception center in the town of Beski. Mr. Orban said his government is abiding strictly by EU rules. He also confirmed he's sending 3,500 troops to defend Hungarian borders and a barbed wire fence along the Serbian border. The European Parliament president argues the EU must show solidarity in distributing the migrants among 28 member nations. He says spreading 500,000 refugees among Europe's population of 507 million is not a problem. French President François Hollande is calling an emergency meeting this afternoon of top government officials from EU countries to address Europe's migrant crisis.
Five countries, Libya, Sudan, Syria, Ukraine, and Yemen, have used cluster munitions this year, causing unacceptable harm to civilians, according to Human Rights Watch. The rights group wants an end to the use of the weapons, which are banned under the 2008 Convention on Cluster Munitions. Officials commented during the release of an annual report by the Cluster Munition Coalition, a group of NGOs co-founded by Human Rights Watch. Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
Cluster bombs were dropped on two locations in Libya early this year, according to Cluster Munition Monitor 2015. It says Sudan's armed forces airdropped cluster bombs in southern Kordofan province in the first half of this year and in 2012. The monitor finds Syrian government forces began using airdropped cluster bombs in mid-2012, and cluster munition rockets and attacks are believed to be continuing. It documents nearly 2,000 civilian casualties, but believes the number is higher. The report says the Islamic State militant group used cluster munition rockets during its advance on Kobani in northern Syria at the end of 2014. The report says Ukrainian government forces and Russian-backed anti-government forces used cluster munition rockets in the Donetsk and Luhansk provinces of eastern Ukraine in 2014. It adds no attacks have taken place since the February ceasefire. Human Rights Watch Advocacy Director Mary Wareham contributed to the report. She says Saudi-led coalition forces use cluster munition rockets in at least 7 attacks in Yemen's northwestern Hajjah governorate, killing and wounding dozens of civilians. She tells VOA, in many cases, the submunitions did not detonate after being dropped by aircraft.
And the villagers had collected them and were giving them to our researchers. Our researchers went to the location where the strike happened on the road, looked at the pattern across the road, looked in the bushes, found another canister. So we see the use of cluster munitions by the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen as being clear and compelling evidence.
Human Rights Watch says submunitions typically fail to explode on impact, leaving duds that act like landmines until cleared and destroyed. None of the 5 countries mentioned in the report signed the treaty banning cluster munitions. Advocates of the ban on such weapons note 117 countries have either ratified or signed it. The Monitor reports treaty member states have destroyed 1.3 million cluster munitions and 160 million submunitions, representing around 90% of declared stockpiles. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
About 13 million children across the Middle East and North Africa are not able to attend school due to ongoing violence and political upheaval. For example, UNICEF, the UN Children's Fund, estimates nearly 9,000 schools in Libya, Syria, Iraq and Yemen are no longer in use. VOA's Jody Kapawa reports.
A new UNICEF report focuses on the impact of violence on students and education systems in 8 countries and Palestine. In Amman, Jordan, Dr. Peter Salama is the UN agency's regional director for the Middle East and North Africa.
We often really get focused on the political and military developments in the Middle East and North Africa at the moment. And what this report is really telling us is the massive human cost, particularly for children, of the crises and conflicts in this region.
The report is called Education Under Fire.
13 million children in these conflict-affected countries are unable to go to school, which represents around a full 40% of the school-aged population in those countries. So it's a tragedy on a grand scale, and it's a tragedy the story of which is not often told.
Salama says there's a disturbing trend that warring parties are deliberately targeting schools in the MENA region. Asked why they would do this, he says,
many, many of the armed groups say that the opposition parties are using schools for military purposes or as bases or as detention centers. I think there are rare instances of that actually happening, but I believe they're exceptions rather than the rule. Sometimes, unfortunately, military groups in this region use the bombarding of civilian infrastructure as a form of collective punishment against the opposing forces and the population that they think is supporting them.
Schools also become collateral damage in conflicts. And then there's the fear factor.
Certainly, families have begun to fear sending their children to school, either because kids have died while they're in the classroom or because of the risks to those children physically on the way to and from school.
In the midst of conflict, kids are forced to grow up fast.
Many of the refugee Syrian children in surrounding countries such as Lebanon, Turkey and Jordan are actually now the primary breadwinners in their family. They're the ones making a living for their families, and so they no longer have time to go to school. As well as that, we know that there's been major efforts by military organizations to recruit children into the armed factions, and more children at a younger age are being abducted and recruited.
And Salama says, don't forget about what's happening in Sudan.
What we don't hear much about is some of these more silent emergencies, as we call them. And in Sudan, there's a full 3 million children who aren't able to go to school because of the various internal conflicts in Sudan.
This includes fighting between Sudanese government forces and rebels in at least 3 regions, including Darfur. The UNICEF regional director says the Middle East and North Africa are on the verge of having a generation of uneducated children. He says the world will pay a price if the problem is ignored. Buddy says there's still time to do something about it.
I think we need to put a lot of pressure on all the parties to the conflict to stop targeting schools, to do much more to protect schools. Secondly, we need to create both informal and formal opportunities to get as many as these 13 million children back into school as we can or into other educational opportunities. We need to create pathways between the informal education that's going on already to a more certified formal education, helping, for example, children do their exams.
Salama says some Syrian children have had to cross the front lines of fighting to get to places where exams were being given. One Syrian girl says she had to travel 14 hours to take her exams. Finally, the UNICEF official says a lot more funding is needed. UNICEF is appealing for $300 million this year to scale up education efforts. The Education Under Fire report quotes a teacher in northern Yemen as saying, "I have seen children trying to write on the ground because they want to learn so much." Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
A Ugandan military spokesman today told the AP 12 Ugandans were killed by Al-Shabaab militants in an attack on an African Union camp in Somalia on Tuesday. Lieutenant Colonel Paddy Ankunda says all troops have been accounted for and none were captured, contrary to earlier claims by Al-Shabaab. Al-Shabaab also claims they killed 50 AU troops in the pre-dawn attack on the military base in the small farming community of Janale. 10 of the Ugandan bodies are being flown back to Kampala today. Ugandan forces patrol the lower Shabelle and Banadir regions of the country. Other troops from Burundi, Djibouti, Ethiopia, and Kenya are part of the 22,000-member military force.
The U.S. State Department has called on Burundi's government to disarm all militias, including the ruling party's youth wing, the Imbonerakure, to prevent a further escalation of violence. Burundi's government says a disarmament program is underway, but critics say the program is targeting areas that opposed the president's bid for a third term. VOA's Mohamed Yusuf reports.
Burundi's capital, Bujumbura, has seen a rise in clashes involving police. Police said Wednesday that officers shot and killed two insurgents who had fired on them. On Sunday, police allegedly killed two opposition activists. Government spokesman Willy Nyamitwe says such attacks have prompted security agencies to carry out sweeps in neighborhoods that have witnessed months of protests.
The police and the army are going into these suburbs to try to remove all the guns from the civilians. So this is what is being done right now, and we hope that in a few days all the guns will be removed from those persons, and those persons who are being sought will be brought to justice.
Witnesses and officials say some residential areas like Jabe in central Bujumbura have seen multiple disarmament raids. Some residents accuse the government of taking revenge against them for demanding that President Pierre Nkurunziza not seek a third term. President Nkurunziza was re-elected in July, but only after withstanding a storm of protests from opponents who said he was violating term limits in the constitution. In his inauguration speech last month, he promised to unite the country, bring an end to violence, and call for what he termed security committees to work with the country's security agencies. The State Department said that call was worrisome, as the committee apparently include the ruling party's militia, the Imbonerakure. Human rights groups have accused the Imbonerakure of attacking protesters and carrying out human rights abuses. Nyamitwe says the president called on all Burundians to work and help security forces to secure the country.
It means that everybody in the country, all the persons, Hutus and Tutsis, and persons from all the religions, all the social groups, should collaborate with the army and the police in order to arrest every person that is suspected, because we need to secure our country 100%.
The United States is still pushing the Burundian government to join opposition leaders in a national dialogue. Without it, some observers fear political tensions could rip apart a country less than a decade removed from civil war. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
The World Health Organization has again declared Liberia Ebola-free after 42 days without a laboratory-confirmed case of the deadly virus. The WHO announced the news today. The nation now goes into a 90-day period of what WHO calls heightened surveillance as health officials watch for any recurrence of the virus. Meanwhile, the BBC reports a woman who recently died in northern Sierra Leone has tested positive for Ebola. It comes as a setback to the country's effort to eradicate the deadly disease. And in Guinea, there were 3 confirmed cases of Ebola as of August 23rd. Here in the U.S., Aissatou Sallia, the wife of Dr. Martin Sallia, who died last November after contracting Ebola in Sierra Leone, plans to carry on her husband's legacy of helping those in need. She spoke with me about how the death of her husband has affected her life and what plans she has for the future.
We're just trying very hard to cope, to be strong. I noticed the boys are watching me so close, and I realize my mood affects them sincerely. So in front of them, I just acting out to be okay sometimes, even though the inside is breaking down. All I'm concerned for now is for them to be okay.
And how are they coping?
Well, just taking it a day at a time, one day at a time.
In looking back at what happened with your husband, he initially thought that perhaps that he had contracted Ebola, but they were running tests, and the first couple of tests showed it was negative. So looking back at all of that, what would you say are some lessons learned in this whole process?
In my husband's case, I know nothing will bring somebody back when he's gone, but I think allowing family members to communicate with their loved ones will be of great help. That's my only wish. Given that opportunity to talk with him, maybe something should have been better than what we're thinking of today.
And this was after he was diagnosed with Ebola and you were trying to reach him, to talk to him. He was still in Sierra Leone, and you were here in Maryland, so you were not able to talk with your husband.
I wasn't given the opportunity to talk with him, and I think that will stay with me for life.
You are planning a memorial service for your husband. Is it that one will take place here in the U.S. and one in Sierra Leone?
Yes, that's what I'm looking at. One here and one in Sierra Leone. We're planning a memorial service here in the United States of America and a full burial and a celebration of life on November 28, 2015 at St. Mary's Parish Church. And I just want to honor him and his colleague healthcare workers that lost their gentle lives through this Ebola crisis in Sierra Leone.
Your husband was doing work in Sierra Leone, community work. He was a surgeon, and also he did other work, too. So I understand you would like to carry on some of the work that he was doing. You, too, are a healthcare worker.
I very much want to continue with my husband's legacy and his vision. Throughout our 22 years of relationship and marriage, I knew him to have that special concern for the sick, the suffering, the underprivileged. He was a great man, yet he was humble and have a very big heart. So out of his own pocket, he bought land in a neighborhood that don't have hospital and hostel. His vision was to build hospital and nursing hostel for the less afforded. And now, as a grieving wife, and he's no more to continue this legacy and vision in Sierra Leone. I already started in creating the Dr. Martin Sallia's Family Foundation, and it has been registered in the state of Maryland. And it will be ready for launching in his memory to continue that vision in Sierra Leone.
Getting your husband back from Sierra Leone when he was so ill back to the United States was quite expensive. And I understand that you did receive some help for that. How did that go in terms of you getting the help and the expenses taken care of?
We thank God that the bills of approximately $245,000 is paid off. And my family and I want to really appreciate those people that make sure this thing happens, these bills are paid. Our family parish, we want to extend our profound thanks to them for Pastor Father Rick at the St. Mary's Catholic Church and the Archdiocese of Washington. They collected over $225,000 donation from generous individuals to pay off my husband's bill. And we also want to recognize the United Methodist Church. They contributed $21,000, which they paid directly to State Department for my husband's bill. That's a huge thing that is paid off.
That was Aissatou Sallia, wife of Dr. Martin Sallia, who died last November from the Ebola virus.
The recent killing of Cecil the Lion in Zimbabwe has sparked a flurry of Chinese aid to protect wildlife in the country. Sebastian Mumfu has more from Harare.
Those are Zimbabwean officials, including Wildlife and Environment Minister Opamuchinguri, clapping after they received anti-poaching equipment worth $100,000 from a group calling itself the Sino-Zim Wildlife Foundation Association.
And I want to thank our Chinese friends who has chipped in to give us a smile. So thank you so much for your support. And this is just a beginning of a journey.
A patrol vehicle and uniforms for anti-poaching officials were among the donated items. Here is the group's founder, Lee Song, explaining the reason for assistance.
Even in Zimbabwe, a paradise of wildlife, lots of wildlife are facing serious challenges, from poaching for trophies by syndicates or for meat by villagers. The pressure of the poaching is being piled onto the authority at a time that has inadequate resources to support its wildlife conservation. The Sino-Zim Wildlife Foundation, therefore, is aiming at coordinating efforts of the Chinese public and private communities to mobilize resources and support for wildlife conservation in Zimbabwe.
The Chinese government has donated an additional $2.3 million to advance conservation efforts. The Zimbabwean Conservation Task Force has previously accused China of decimating the country's wildlife. The independent conservation group has complained about baby elephants being taken to zoos in China. China is known to be a major destination for illegally poached ivory and other wildlife products. But conservationists hope a shift is underway. China declared a one-year ban on ivory imports earlier this year. The country has also pledged to phase out its domestic ivory industry. The support follows the killing of what men considered an iconic Zimbabwean lion named Cecil in July. The lion was killed by an American dentist outside a protected reserve in Zimbabwe, sparking fury all over the world. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here, only the best on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. As Hungary struggles with thousands of migrants headed for European refuge, Prime Minister Viktor Orban complains that the crisis is Germany's problem. According to Human Rights Watch, five countries, among them Libya and Sudan, have used cluster munitions this year. And about 13 million children across the Middle East and North Africa are not able to attend school due to ongoing violence and political upheaval. Coming up, we'll have music from the DRC, and in our feature segment, the United States and African nations meet in Gabon on the African Growth and Opportunity Act. I'm Kim Lewis with the Hayes Wuhi Bands. We're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. It's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Thursday, Sunny.
Happy Thursday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, understand the Commonwealth Games top your sports report today.
Kim, with the All-Africa Games officially celebrating a 50th anniversary this week in Congo Brazzaville, let's look ahead a bit at another international multi-sports competition to be held on the continent. South Africa has been awarded the 2022 Commonwealth Games. It will mark the first time the Games will be held in Africa. The president of South Africa's Olympic Committee is Gideon Sam.
His Royal Highness Prince Imran, members of the CGF Executive and members of the Evaluation Committee, I stand before you today an extremely proud South African. We are ready to host the 2022 Commonwealth Games for the first time on the African soil in Durban, eThekwini, South Africa in 2022. The fundamental premise of our submission is that the Games will provide an opportunity to fast-track our development both at an economic and social level. In particular, the development and inspiration of our young people, not only in South Africa, but in the rest of the Commonwealth. Youth empowerment sits at the core of our legacy program, a legacy which will begin upon your awarding us the Games.
The 2022 Commonwealth Games will be held from July 18th to July 31st in Durban, opening on the birth date of the late South African president and anti-apartheid hero Nelson Mandela. The opening and closing ceremonies, as well as the athletics action, will be held at the Moses Mabhida Stadium, which hosted matches during the 2010 Football World Cup in South Africa. You can see a photo of the stadium at the Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. The address of my Facebook page is facebook.com/VOA Sunny. And three of my Facebook friends in Nigeria have chipped in their comments over South Africa winning the hosting rights to the 2022 Commonwealth Games. Felix Ukwe, writing from Warri, Nigeria, writes, "Congratulations to Africa, and most especially South Africa." SSX Man, one of my friends in Ouchi, Nigeria, says, "Good luck to South Africa." And Paul Confi, writing from Abuja, Nigeria, says, "Long way to go, Mr. Sunny. Wishing Mama Africa and its athletes all the very best by then."
Hi, I'm Shegwa Adeyemi, coming to you all the way from Lagos, Nigeria. Weekends are for sports. Nightline Africa Sports, that is. And every Sunday, I'll give you highlights of the top sports stories of the past week and the weekend. Nightline Africa Sports from the Voice of America. Let the games begin. We got the game.
Game on, VOA sports fans. In African athletics, Kenya's Jeffrey Rono will defend his title in Saturday's Borel Prague Grand Prix 10-kilometer road race in the Czech Republic. When he's not training for his next race, Jeffrey leads an interesting life back home in Kenya. The energetic Andy Edwards caught up with Jeffrey Rono in Prague to find out more. Here's Andy.
I'm sitting here a couple of days before the Borel Prague Grand Prix with the winner of last year's title, Jeffrey Rono of Kenya. Now, you might think we're going to talk about his prospects for the race, and he's the course record holder, and he had big wins over Wilson Kipsang and Jeffrey Mutai last year. Indeed, we are. But first of all, we're going to hear about a side of Jeffrey Rono, which I've only learned about in the last hour or so, and that is Jeffrey Rono, Kenyan wildlife ranger. And it's not a sinecure, it's a real job he combines with his running. Jeffrey, you were telling me that you've been a wildlife ranger in Kenya for 11 years, and you combine this with what we call a professional running career that you've trained seriously since 2012, so 3 years. What first motivated you to become a wildlife ranger?
I became motivated to be a wildlife ranger since my school days time. I was motivated to the fact that in my village I have some people who have been working there as rangers, others working as police, and also others working as from Kenya Defence Forces. So I really liked the way they were dressing, the way they were behaving when they come to our homes. Sometimes they could bring biscuits to when we were young, and
you and your friends when you were boys, you spend weekends, would you? I mean, tracking animals, hunting animals in the bush. I mean, kind of for fun, which, of course, we now would think, well, that's also training for running in disguise. But you were always active and out there in the bush, tracking and in a sense, perhaps rehearsing to be a ranger.
Yeah. When we were young boys, we used to, over the weekend and holidays, to go and hunt. But it later turns down for me to be a ranger. I'm not safeguarding them instead of hunting, like before. So at first, we were hunting for just only for fun. But in later days, it all turns down that I'm not the one who's looking out of them. No more kidding.
Now, you're very active. I mean, people might think, oh, yes, you're a ranger, but perhaps in name only. But in our chat earlier over dinner, you've assured me you do your duties fully as a ranger. And sometimes you could be, say, on duty 5 days straight, and you do regular night shift as a ranger on sentry duty. So how do you combine that with training at the level you do? I mean, you ran 27:28 for the Prague 10K to win it last year. That is really fast. How do you combine your two lives, ranger and runner?
I've been taking it positively. First, I decide to utilize my time that I get. I try to budget my time, and I know that after this, I will be doing this. So my sentry duty is just only normal duty like any other duty. I just only, when I am in night duty, I take it to be a day, so that I train in the day and sleep. So it's just only a matter of changing times of rest, yeah.
And when you're out on, well, anti-poaching operations, you and your colleagues in the ranger force, I mean, you come into contact with poachers, don't you? I mean, you're carrying a gun. You got trained by the British Army, who often come out to train to train themselves in Kenya. But you're out there, in a way, on the front line, aren't you, hunting down poachers?
Yeah, that's been my duty. I've been working there for the last 11 years, At first, I go for mandatory military training. I have been attending some things like refreshers. It's a continuous training with British Army training unit in Kenya, that is in Nanyuki. So it's just a matter of techniques. And concerning the work of ranger, I have come across several contacts with poachers. Yeah, we call it in Kenya, we call it shifters. I've recovered some cans. I've recovered also some ivories, of which it has been cut out. So it's a normal duty. Yeah.
Well, certainly adds variety to your life. Let's turn to Geoffrey Rono as the runner. As I said, course record holder from your win last year, and you beat Geoffrey Mutai into second place. And earlier, you beat Wilson Kipsang in the Olomouc half marathon, also part of the Run Check series. You had a couple of injury problems this year. You didn't run the Olomouc half this June because of hamstring trouble. So what's your form like now? You've been back home in Eton, but how are you feeling for Saturday night's race?
This year I was not such lucky enough because of minor injuries, but I'm now picking up. The last few trainings have been going on well. I'm now back to my normal shape.
You were so dominant, so strong last year. Is there perhaps in your mind a worry that you can't be quite as strong again, or do you feel really fit in your mind as well as your body?
I am back to my shape. At now I'm in good shape. Yeah, so I've come back.
You ran 2:10 for the marathon in Prague in May, and then again you seem to be having some injury problems after that. Is also the Prague Grand Prix, the 10K race on Saturday night, is that also something that you can see as a yardstick in terms of, is your real potential, do you feel, at the marathon?
Yeah. I am in good form now. I've recovered well. I'm ready to run on Saturday, and I wish to improve on my time before going for the next marathon before the end of this year.
Well, interesting prospect, and that was Geoffrey Rono, not only defending champion in the Birol Prague Grand Prix 10K on this Saturday evening in the Czech capital, but also a Kenyan wildlife ranger. Geoffrey, thank you very much for that insight into your, may I say, double life. Thank you, Geoffrey.
Thank you, Joe.
American tennis star Serena Williams remains on course for the first calendar year Grand Slam since 1988. Serena beat Dutch opponent Kiki Bertens in straight sets 7-6 and 6-3 to advance to the third round of the U.S. Open in New York City. Serena is bidding for her fourth consecutive singles title in New York, and she's trying to become the first player since Steffi Graf 27 years ago to win all four major tournaments in the same year. Next up for Serena Williams is American countrywoman Bethany Mattek-Sands, who advanced to the third round of the U.S. Open for the first time by beating another American, Coco Vandeweghe. Meanwhile, Serena's older sister, Venus Williams, also advanced to the third round with a three-set victory over American Irina Falcone. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yeheyes Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, the United States and African nations meet in Gabon on the African Growth and Opportunity Act. And next, youth unemployment remains high in Kenya. But first, some music. Here is Fally Ipupa of the DRC with Ndoki.
ngana numero moko na yebite soki na bengi na zwa kashinwa moko soki na lobi alo bonjour azongi c'est la ganga alo ha ntoko solola nini motema pazie moto zala kyo benga papa lelo papa bongwani akomi tala tonton oyo moto zala kyo benga mama lelo mama bongwani akomi vraiment tala petit oyo mama mama président big master
Oh, 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 oh
Ali Pupa of the DRC with Ndoki.
Well, the United States and African nations met recently in Gabon on the African Growth and Opportunity Act. It's the first forum since Congress reviewed AGOA's zero-tariff deal for Africa. Mariama Diallo reports.
Exhibitors at the AGOA Forum in the Gabonese capital, Libreville, are ready to take full advantage of exporting their products into the U.S. tax-free. U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, says more countries can benefit from AGOA.
We are working with those countries through our trade hubs and through consultations with American companies and trade ministers to try to increase the productivity of companies that are exporting to the United States to increase the quality.
She says it's a long-term process and won't happen overnight. While this is an exciting time for the Gabonese leadership, the average person in Libreville doesn't know what AGOA is.
Personally, this is the first time I am hearing about AGOA.
Another resident says he hopes young entrepreneurs like him can get help.
It's always been difficult because banks around here do not give us loans or help us in any way. They don't take chances on us, so hope AGOA can help us with a solution.
Few African economies have taken advantage of the U.S. trade initiative. The Durban Chamber of Commerce chief executive says the trade partnership has helped advance South Africa's manufacturing sector.
South Africa has been able to grow the export of, besides the citrus, which are agricultural goods, we've been able to export an enormous amount of vehicles, parts, into the U.S. market.
But Whitney Schneiderman, a non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institutions, told VOA via Skype that there have been some disparities.
South Africa exports about $4 billion worth of products to the U.S. under AGOA, and I don't think there's another country that even reaches $1 billion. So I think it's really a challenge for the U.S. and for all AGOA beneficiaries to figure out how to take better advantage of the legislation.
But while economies of countries like South Africa have grown, other African leaders have said their countries lack the skilled labor and infrastructure to take advantage of AGOA. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
Youth unemployment remains high in Kenya, but the nation's universities continue to churn out new graduates from the slim job market. Some students with fresh degrees are learning that farming and related industries can provide good jobs with significant financial rewards. Raila Mbor has our report.
This is one of Caleb's four farmlands that he leased to practice agribusiness 3 years ago. He grows vegetables and keeps poultry and dairy cows. The 33-year-old says many youth are venturing into agribusiness, which does not require a lot of capital to start.
Many times people think that you need a lot of money to get into agribusiness. With $100, you're good to lease some land, really. In Kenya, in a part of this country, 1 acre, you're good to go.
Increasing numbers of young people are taking up farming, and the sector is growing. Diana Kuya, a diplomacy student at the University of Nairobi, has identified some land that is for lease and plans to start pursuing agribusiness once she is done with her studies.
Knowledge is important, but it's not everything, you know. You have to be wise. You would wait for that white-collar job so that you start getting your own money, so that you become independent and all that stuff. And an amazing thing about agriculture is that you can start it at whatever age.
Jacob Neitu, an economist, agrees. He says this is one of the reasons why the government is pumping billions into the sector, with an aim of pushing agriculture from subsistence to business.
People are no longer seeing agriculture as a way for those who cannot make it, but instead it's becoming a sector which can attract each and every one of us, so it can solve the very big unemployment problem that we are currently facing.
Agricultural experts say there has been a change of attitude and a realization that the agricultural sector can be rewarding if done right. However, they say people new to farming, like student Diana Kuya, will need mentors to guide them as they try to create something for themselves and others in the future. Rael Umbur for VOA News, Nairobi.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Huhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In the final days of August, the Nigerian-based terrorist group Boko Haram carried out a half dozen raids on villages in northeast Nigeria, reportedly killing more than 80 people. The United States strongly condemns these attacks. These raids are just another example of the horrific and indiscriminate violence that Boko Haram continues to use to terrorize civilians in northeastern Nigeria and the Lake Chad Basin region. Governor of Nigeria's Borno State, Kashim Shettima, confirmed the attacks. According to the Associated Press, he said, "I want us all to understand that the Boko Haram crisis is a calamity that has befallen us, as the insurgents do not discriminate whether somebody is Christian or Muslim. Neither do they have any tribal sympathy or affiliations." August 27th marked the 500th day since Boko Haram kidnapped 276 girls from their school in Chibok. The kidnapping galvanized international attention for the Boko Haram conflict. It is one of many attacks, kidnappings, raids, and other acts of indiscriminate violence that continue on a frequent basis in Nigeria, Chad, Niger, and Cameroon. According to press reports, Boko Haram has killed more than 15,000 people since 2009. Nigeria's new president, Muhammadu Buhari, recently visited Washington, where he and President Barack Obama discussed ongoing plans to defeat the terrorist group Boko Haram. President Obama expressed his support for President Buhari's very clear agenda in defeating Boko Haram extremists of all sorts inside his country. The U.S. contributes to these efforts through a number of security and counterterrorism assistance programs, which provide intelligence, advisors, training, equipment, and logistics. The United States also provides support to the multinational joint task force, which the Lake Chad Basin countries and Benin are standing up to coordinate the regional efforts to counter Boko Haram. The United States will continue to support the governments and people of the Lake Chad Basin region in their struggle to defeat Boko Haram.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.